be around the world. And thank you for joining us once again on truth2u.org. That's truth, a number two, letter U.org. Joining me is the author of the website Silver Trumpets. The website address is b'naimikra.wordpress.com. That's b'naimikra.wordpress.com. He also manages the Facebook group American Karaite Judaism. Welcome back to the program, Isaac Kite.
A pleasure as always, John.
Lovely to have you again, my friend. A couple of comments. We got quite a few comments, actually, since the last program. I'm just going to read a couple of them. Jeremiah said, it's about time for some Karaite perspectives. Great interview, John. I love your stuff. Thanks, Jeremiah. Appreciate it. Derek. G'day, Derek in Canada. Mate of mine, he said, thank you, Isaac and Jono, for this very informative perspective. Really mind-blowing historical facts. Thank you. In the next conversation, which won't be this one, but maybe the next one, in the next conversation, Derek asks with Isaac, could you ask his opinion on how and why having a Jewish mother became to be recognized as a Jew in Orthodox Judaism? So he's asking about matrilineal versus patrilineal. Excellent question. I think would we be able to address that perhaps next time we speak?
Sounds good. That's definitely an interesting topic.
We're going to add that to another topic that was asked, a comment that I read last time. We've got a list. We've got a list going, and we'll get around to them eventually. So as people, if you have questions, things that you'd like us to discuss, by all means, leave them in the comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now, in this discussion, you very recently, Isaac, Toba Mangubi and Ken Lane, we discussed the mechanics of Torah as far as the reckoning of a month, how does a month begin, as well as the reckoning of the new year. We did discuss some of that in detail, but you have recently published an article on your website, just simply called The Jewish Calendar. And within this article, you highlight the differences between rabbinic and Karaite calendars. You also make some controversial observations. I'd like to get to those. But to begin with, let's perhaps talk about some of the differences. And before we even go there, what do we know? Let me ask you this question, and you do touch on it in your article. What do we know about ancient calendars? You make mention of the Egyptian calendar. You also make mention of the Sumerian. You also make mention of the Sumerian model. Now, recently in a Facebook thread, which we will also get to on American Karaite Judaism, you do make mention that in the time of Torah, a solar-corrected lunar calendar was observed. Give me the details, Isaac.
Okay, well, it's fun. Well, thank you. First of all, ancient calendars. People look on the ancient world, and for some reason, we have a hard time understanding that these people had brains, and they had minds, and they thought. Right. And believe it or not, they were able to do some very complex mathematics,
yes,
like we are able to do today. So ancient peoples understood how long a year was. 1,000 years before the Israelites entered Egypt during the first dynasty, Egypt had two primary calendars that they used. One was a 365-day solar calendar, and the other was a corrected lunar calendar. And I'll talk about that in a second. You can figure out that the Earth revolves around the sun every 365 days very easily. With any sundial, you can mark the points on it, and every year you'll notice that after 365 days, they come across the exact same points. Mm-hmm. So this is not impossible to determine. The extra quarter of a day, because it's actually 365.25 and a little bit of pocket change after that, this we came to understand a little bit later. In any case, you can understand the solar year. But the solar year, while it is interesting from the point of view of keeping track of time, agricultural planting seasons are based more closely on the moon. And so for millennia, human beings have been planting based on the way the lunar cycle works, because that's a better calendar for the agricultural season, a better predictor of when the Nile's inundations will come. Because, mm-hmm, of course, the moon is, and its revolutions around the Earth, is connected to the weather, to the tides, to the currents in the ocean, and to the seasons. So this is why they had a corrected lunar calendar. This lunar calendar provided for the agricultural season. So the moon revolves around the Earth in one orbit once every 29 and a half days, mm-hmm, which means that Some months are 29 days and some months are 30 days in length on the lunar calendar. And this adds up to a total of 354 days, which is, as you can imagine, 11 days short of a solar year. So what happens there is if you don't correct the lunar calendar, you're going to be moving 11 days back on the solar calendar, which means that a holiday like Yom Kippur would keep moving from the fall up into the summer and then eventually into the spring.
And you experience what is called seasonal drift, as we observe in the Islamic calendar.
That's right. The Al-Hijra calendar moves around the year like that. And so Ramzan, or Ramadan, as some call it, moves throughout the year to different points. In our calendar, the Jewish calendar, like the ancient Egyptian calendars, it's solar corrected. You can't add extra days to a lunar calendar because you'll lose your lunar cycle. So you have to add a complete lunar month. And so we do this once every so many years. There's two ways to do that. One is there's a strong implication that the ripeness of the barley can be used as a measure. That's going to happen about the same time every year on a solar basis because the sun and the seasons have to do with that.
Let me stop you there, and I'm really sorry to catch you in the middle of a thought, but the observation of the barley is not a solar correction. It's an agricultural observation. It's and yes, the ripeness of the barley is dependent upon where the sun is, you know, that time of the year. But it's not a it in and of itself is not a a solar correction. Is that fair? I just wanted to point that out and make a distinction there.
Sure. Yeah, it's not the sun itself. We're not looking at the sun and where the sun is in the sky or anything like that to correct. But we have this event that happens once a year, approximately the same time on the solar calendar, and that allows us to correct. If we see the ripeness of the barley during the 12th month, at the next new moon, we start the first month. If we don't see it, we start a 13th month, and that gives us our extension. So that extra month throws the rest of the calendar, the holidays, a little farther back, but it keeps them in their seasons. We will still have the 7th month holidays, Yom Teruah, Yom Kippur, the Hag HaSukkot. These will all be in the fall, which is their proper time. Shavuot will be at the end of the spring. The Pesach will be at the beginning of the spring, and we'll always have these holidays in their proper season. And that calendar, and a calendar like it, was in use in Egypt 1,000 years before the Israelites even showed up there. And the Sumerians also used a similar calendar. Obviously, the Torah gives a strong indication that Abraham and his family were originally from Ur, that they were Sumerians. So we have all of that in the ancient times. That's what gives us our calendar. Now, the Torah itself isn't very specific about the calendar, and for the obvious reason that just like with slaughtering, everyone kind of understood how the calendar worked, or at least those in leadership did. Everyone in ancient times knew how to slaughter an animal properly, that the best way to do it was by exsanguination. So these practices, being that they were commonly known, we don't get a lot of detail of about them written in the scripture because that detail isn't necessary. We already have a calendar. There'll just be vague passing references to the different months
And corrections to this. So coming out of Egypt and the calendar that they used, there are corrections. So, for example, in Egypt, I think they observed a 10-day week, if I remember correctly. It's not as if I'm that old, but if I remember from what I've studied in Egyptian history, I think they had a 10-day week. Hashem says, you know, remember my Sabbath. And so on and so forth. So 7 days in Egypt, they had a they did have a solar lunar, but they also had an agricultural observation, which was the flooding of the Nile, which you alluded to just earlier. And of course, once you come out of Egypt, you no longer have that observation. You are now in the land of Israel, and the agricultural observation that you made reference to is the observation of the ripeness, particular stage of the ripeness of the barley. In Egypt, there was also, I think, a particular star, Sirius, I think, had to be spotted at a certain time of the year and so on and so forth. There are some differences. But when we come out and we read about it in Exodus chapter 12, of course, Hashem seems to be more concerned with this is the beginning of months for you. It happens here. And this is the way, these are some of the differences. This is the way that you will observe it from here on, fair?
Yes. The Torah is given in a given cultural context. Many of the laws that are written in the Torah are very similar to the Code of Ur-Nammu, which preceded the Torah, that's a Sumerian law code. Mm-hmm. And there are some, people have noted, some similarities to Egyptian laws. What is really interesting, of course, Moshe is giving these laws to the people and giving them in a context. So most people are going to be familiar with these laws already. The ways in which they differ from these other systems are key. There are a lot fewer capital crimes than in the Torah than there are in a lot of these other legal systems. And we have much kinder ways of going about seeking justice. Mm-hmm. The Torah is focused very much on you're going to go forward from here. Some of the details, like the calendar and some other details in other areas, are omitted because they're not necessary. The priests, the hachamim, the kings and judges will provide the necessary details, the tradition and the practice over and above that, which will include the calendar. And so the calendar that we're supposed to keep has to do with when we're going to have our festivals, which festivals we're going to have in which months, and mm-hmm. these kinds of things. So the Torah is more concerned with when you're going to observe the Hag HaMatzot, or Passover, as it was called, when you're going to observe Shavuot and these kinds of things, and how that's done, rather than the specifics of when are you going to have the first month.
Now, can I go to just something that you have, a couple of controversial comments that you made, that I thought were controversial in any case. You say in the article, the Karaite Council of Hakamim in Ramle, Israel, calculates the calendar each year well in advance. Some argue that the new moon must be seen in order to confirm the new month, but the Torah includes no such requirement. The sighting is helpful to confirm the accuracy of the calendar. Now, here you seem to be arguing for a pre-calculated month. We know that the moon is visible on such and such a day, and let's lock that in now. You also go on to say, since the Torah provides no specific instruction that the ripe barley must be seen, it is implied that a calculation could suffice. Are you... what I'd like to talk about is the differences between the Karaite calendar, the biblical calendar, and the what has become known as the calendar of Hillel II, Hillel the Second. And are you in favor or making allowances for pre-calculation?
Yes, and actually, as I point out in the article, I myself am a great fan of the Hillel the Second calendar.
Now, that statement in and of itself is, I would imagine, somewhat controversial in Karaite circles, right?
It might be. Having practiced rabbinical Judaism for a number of years before I came to Karaism, I learned quite a bit about rabbinical practice and the origins of rabbinical tradition, and I continue to learn more on a daily basis if I can. But the fact is, the Torah does not specifically require the sighting of the new moon. In fact, it's only by inference that we determine that the new moon has anything to do with the month. It is not specific about the sighting of the barley and Aviv. These are traditions built out of what we read. And those traditions can be done very physically, go out and look at the barley, or they can be calculated. Mm-hmm. The Hillel the Second calendar finds its origins in the Babylonian calendar. The reasons called the Hillel the Second calendar, as I note in the article, Hillel the Second was one of the last princes of the Sanhedrin. And at the time, the Sanhedrin was meeting this, the Romans were persecuting Jews, and so it was somewhat dangerous for them to meet. And they decided that instead of meeting to discuss the calendar, they were going to go ahead and have it calculated. And Hillel the Second left instructions for the 19-year cycle. Interestingly enough, if you drop the seven leap months into a 19-year cycle, you reach a precise alignment with the solar calendar. Mm-hmm. So every 19 years, the solar and lunar calendars align perfectly, and you have completed 19 solar years and 19 lunar years at that point. Mm. So we add these seven leap months in, and this is all pre-calculated. So this calendar, the Hillel the Second calendar, which was developed later by some of the rabbinical Geonim and I want to say perfected, is entirely pre-calculated. It's very automatic. The months go, and then the next month starts. It's all calculated well in advance. You could calculate what month it's going to be 20 years from now or 200 years from now, mm-hmm. because it's calculated. And that includes in this calculation when we have the leap months. And even though it is pre-calculated and automatic, it does align very closely with the lunar cycle. Not precisely, but very closely with it. So the Hillel the Second calendar offers Judaism a universal calendar where we can all observe the same holidays on exactly the same day when the sun sets in your time zone, in my time zone, or wherever in the world on that given day, that holiday begins. And it allows us to have uniformity.
It allows us to have uniformity. It has to be acknowledged that it is a work of mathematical genius. It is very, very accurate. And it does, as you say, quite often overlap with the Karaite calendar. Now, you know, there's a lot of people that are listening intently to this discussion because there is the question every year at this time of the year, if not before, as we approach the biblical new year, Isaac, there are people who are listening going, you know, every year I have this problem where I have a job that requires me to submit my leave well in advance so that I can take, you know, the necessary days off. When it comes to the agricultural observation of the barley, the stage of the ripeness of the barley, they're literally in limbo. They're waiting to see, you know, when, and then you have other problems. Like you have one group that say we're the authority to determine the barley, and we're looking at them, and we declare that. And then you have another group saying, well, no, we've been south and north, and we've looked at this barley, and it's not. And they have. I've quite often seen discussions, arguments, in fact, back and forth. Well, I have sighted the barley. Well, no, you're not the people who should do such a thing. And it goes on and on and on. And people are going, hey, I just want to know, when do I take off my days now? With such when I spoke to Ken and Toma recently, they did point out that the moon is in the diaspora. It's always the month is always reckoned by the local moon. When you see the moon,
that's right.
There it is. Now, when it comes to the year, not so much. When it comes to the year, you're waiting on reports from Israel saying yes, the barley has been sighted. Now that's easier these days, of course, because we have the internet and we can know within, you know, like that. But even so, you're waiting until, you know, March or April, where you can go, right, let me now calculate all the days that I have for the year. And sometimes it's just not good enough for people with employment that require such days be submitted, particularly in a teamwork environment where lots of different people are taking off lots of different days. You've got to fit it all in. They want to know well in advance, and so it becomes a problem. Now, in this case, the rabbinic calendar comes in very, very handy. In fact, I'll also say I have met people, and perhaps you have as well, that will say, well, you know what? I'm just going to go with the first new moon after the equinox, and I'm just going to calculate everything from there. And they do so, and in such a way, they always have, Pesach on the evening of the 14th, or they always have everything on the right days, which is not necessarily the case in the rabbinic calendar, right? So thoughts on that?
Well, that's an interesting thing. First of all, I already have April 11th off for me. So that is a valuable thing to be able to say, hey, I know exactly when this holiday is going to fall, and I've already got that day set aside. Mm-hmm. But this is not a new problem. This is not a new problem. 2,500 years ago, I'm manning my merchant shop in Babylon, in Babel, in the city, the capital of Chaldea, and I want to know when, you know, the holidays are going to be. And this, for me, involves a trip, a journey from modern-day Iraq all the way over to Jerusalem. Now, if I leave in the wrong month, I'm going to be waiting in Jerusalem a whole month for the holiday to arrive. Mm-hmm. And that's complicated. There were Jews, we know, living in the islands, living in Cyprus and in the Ionian Sea. So the need to know well in advance when the holidays was going to be is not a new problem. And even in ancient times, I mean, again, if you're living in Shunem or up in the north among the tribe of Asher near Lebanon, you're in these different places. Gad, Reuben, you're on the other side of the Jordan. You need to know when you're going to Jerusalem for the given holiday so that you can make your offerings. So this is not a new problem. The use of the equinox I would not support because there's no biblical support for that. Yes, you could theoretically calculate it that way, I think the way that the Hillel II calendar is calculated is an excellent one. The Karaite calendar is pre-calculated every year based on similar calculations and with an understanding of approximately when the Aviv is going to be. Is it perfect? No, but it works. Mm-hmm. And the wonderful thing about it is when it comes to what's written in the Torah, we have enough vagary. There's enough room for maneuver that we're able to do this calculation. And there's no reason that once the priesthood and the Levites are reestablished, that they could not simply issue a priestly statute saying, this is the calendar we're going to use. This is how we're going to calculate it. So that everyone will know when they need to be in Jerusalem for the Hag, mm-hmm. you know, for the pilgrimage festival. And this is just so important to be able to know ahead of time, because you don't want to have confusion. And you don't want to have people wondering when they're supposed to be there. And I've got all my offerings with me, and I've made the trip all the way from Bavel, and I'm a month off. You know, maybe it happened a month ago. Maybe I've completely missed the Hag, right? Or based on whatever report I heard, I came a month early, and these kinds of things. So we need to know in advance. And the wonderful thing about the Hillel II calendar is that there's never any confusion. You're always going to know when the holidays are, whether you're in Australia, in the United States, in Israel, the Crimea, or in Kaifeng, China. The date is the same.
Right. Now, tell us about some of the differences, specific differences, though, between, for example, Shavuot. When you say that the rabbinic calendar, it overcomes these problems that we've just spoken about, but it's going to have some significant differences.
Yes, and those differences are substantial. First of all, the names of the months on the rabbinical calendar. Some of those names are Babylonian names. Tammuz was a Babylonian deity. Mm-hmm. And it's really unfortunate that there are still Jews today who mourn during the month of Tammuz, because this is a pagan practice that has unfortunately stayed with us for 25 centuries. Tells you that, you know, some wicked practices, you know, die hard. Right. They don't go away. So there are a number of problems with that. The Torah lists the months by number, as do most of the scriptures. And as I list in the article, there are different names given in different books for the months. For example, by the end of the Ketuvim, the writings, we're referring to the first month as the month of Nisan, as opposed to Aviv, which is what it's called in the Torah. So there's different months and different traditions along those lines. So I would differ with our rabbinical brethren in that I would not use the names that they give for the months.
Right.
I prefer the biblical numbering, the first month, the second month, the third month.
Sure.
So I'm able to say that my birthday is the fifth day of the second month. Mm-hmm. And it's just that simple. That also happens to be Israeli Independence Day, of which I'm very proud.
Nice.
So it's a good day to be born. Anyhow, we have these we have those differences. We have a few differences in the holidays as well. So the biggest one and the most obvious one is Rosh Hashanah. The rabbinical interpretation is that there are four New Years. And this is kind of silly. this is going to sound really profound and really strange here when I mention that in Karaite Judaism, there's one New Year. I know that's hard to comprehend, that there could only be one New Year, you know, for a calendar. But in fact, we have one New Year. Might blow your mind. Our rabbinical brethren, unfortunately, have four. They say that there's a New Year for tithes in the beginning of the sixth month. That there's a new year at the beginning of the seventh month, which they call Rosh Hashanah, the first of the year. And they've converted the Torah holiday, Yom Teruah, the day of shouting, which is the first day of the seventh month. They've converted that into a two-day holiday that they call New Year, Rosh Hashanah, first of the year.
Now, let me ask you, just hold that thought before we go into the details there, because, Rosh Hashanah versus Yom Teruah, we did touch on this when I was talking with Ken and Toma, and one observation was made that Rosh Hashanah is a new year of sorts, with the understanding that the Rosh Hashanah or Yom Teruah is, if you like, the beginning of the business year, and it is the year by which the Shemitah year is calculated. Does this ring a bell with you? Does it justify referring it to as a new year of sorts?
That the Shemitah year starts there does not make it a new year. It just means that this is the time at which this year, this particular custom is to begin. And when the Torah lists out when that's to begin, it refers to it as the seventh month. So,
and it has to be so, doesn't it? Because agriculturally speaking, that's when your agricultural business comes to a close at that time of the year, and you bring in the harvest and so on and so forth.
That's right.
And here we are. That makes sense. But so then, is it? I mean, as I mentioned to Ken and Toma, here in Australia, our business year begins on the 1st of July and ends on, and it goes for 1 year. July is where it kicks over. Can we view the seventh month as a similar thing? This is where the business year begins and ends.
How you do your tax year? You know, for example, in the United States, most states run their budget from July 1st to June 30th. The United States government runs its budget from October 1st through September 30th. Most corporations use December 31st as the end of a tax year, but their budgets can often start in other times of the year. Mm-hmm. So the board might approve a budget that begins March 1st and ends February 28th or 29th. So these kinds of things can happen. That does not justify creating a New Year holiday at
right.
the first day of the seventh month,
yep.
nor can you ever, nor can any corporeal human authority ever change the name of a Torah holiday.
Hmm.
It's if you're a Torah observer, the first day of the seventh month is Yom Teruah. It cannot be anything else.
Hmm.
If you are saying it's something else, you are not a Torah observer. You're observing some commandment learned by rote. And this is a big difference between Karaism and the rabbinical tradition. We don't allow men, human beings of any kind, to make those kinds of changes. You cannot change one word. You cannot change one interpretation. The Torah is what the Torah is. You can't change the words of it. You can, and when I say interpretation, you can understand things differently in different times. You can have different traditions. We can understand traditions differently. Interpretations can change over time. But the fact is, there is always going to be one correct interpretation
mm-hmm.
based on what is written, using grammatical evidence, using words and how they're used in context elsewhere in the scriptures and the various other methods of Karaite exegesis. And where all of that fails, we have rational thought processes, and we're going to stay close to what is written. We're not going to go dive off the deep end somewhere and come up with some idea that some rabbi had because he was bored one day and thought something up. So it's Yom Teruah. The Shemitah year begins there. You know, like you say, that's a bit of a change with the agricultural cycle, and it's the Torah acknowledging that we have an agricultural cycle that differs from the civil calendar, the religious calendar. And again, the Torah is also a constitution for a nation. This is the calendar of a people, of a nation. And so there are going to be different iterations of that. But that doesn't justify creating a new year there. And interestingly enough, the new year at the beginning of the seventh month would conveniently coincide with the Babylonian New Year, which happens at precisely the same time.
Right.
So again, there are no coincidences.
Right.
And that's just a little too convenient.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's one New Year. There's also a rabbinical tradition of Tu B'Shvat, which is New Year for the trees. Rabbinical tradition has four New Years. Karaite tradition has one. The one New Year is at the beginning of the month of Aviv, the first month, and 14 days later we have the Hag HaMatzot, the Pesach, the Passover. So that's the one New Year. That's one big area. Another big area of difference that you'll find between the rabbinical and the Karaite calendar is the counting of the Omer. And this is really a critical thing. So in Vayikra, or Leviticus as it's translated, chapter 23 talks about holidays. And during the talk, the portion where it's giving commandments regarding the Hag HaMatzot, the Passover, it talks about, you know, the first day you will do no work. It goes on down. And in verse 15, we have this little snippet. You shall count from the morning after the Shabbat, from the day that you brought the Omer offering, the sheaf of waving, also called, seven Shabbats you shall complete. And it says Shabbats in plural, Shabbatot. It's very important.
Mm.
So in our reading of it, the Karaite reading, in the Sadducee reading, in the Samaritan reading, and according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Temple Scroll also includes a reference to this.
Mm-hmm.
During the Hag HaMatzot, there is a Shabbat. There is a Shabbat during the Hag HaMatzot.
Mm.
And after that Shabbat, the next day, Yom Rishon, the first day, is the day of Omer, where you will bring the first Omer of your crop to the priests. And this is also called the sheaf of waving. You know, the priests wave it over the altar.
Hmm.
So you bring the Omer to the priests on that day. That is the first day of counting the Omer. And because it's the first day, you will count 7 weeks. Each week concludes with a Shabbat. 7 weeks, seven Shabbats. Mm-hmm. And it says right there in verse 15, seven Shabbatot you will count, right? Mm-hmm. And then Shavuot is the 50th day. Shavuot comes after the seventh Shabbat. And it's a pilgrimage festival, Hag HaShavuot, of weeks, right? Because we're counting weeks. And we're not just counting Egyptian weeks. We're not counting Roman weeks. We're counting Jewish weeks, which run from the first day to the seventh day, the day of rest, right? And this is the way all of those traditions counted. And this is the evidence we have from ancient times. Our rabbinical brethren believe that the first day of the Hag HaMatzot, since it's called a day of rest, is actually the first day, or that Shabbat that's being referenced in verse 15. Mm-hmm. And they very conveniently translate it as 7 weeks you will count, so that in most English translations, you won't even see that it says seven Shabbats you will count. And so they count from the second day of the Hag HaMatzot, whatever day that happens to be. So if we have the first day of the Hag on Tuesday, the day of the Omer will be Wednesday. And they will count 7 weeks from there, regardless of whether the seventh day falls on a Shabbat or not. Right. And they'll have the Hag HaShavuot on the 50th day. Could be a Thursday, could be a Wednesday, could be a Tuesday. Interestingly enough, it can never be Shabbat. The Talmud says that Shavuot can never coincide with Shabbat. And the reason for that, in reality, is if you read the scripture, you're supposed to have Shavuot on the Sunday after the seventh Shabbat.
Right.
That's how the Shavuot is supposed to be observed. So is a big
thing. Curiosity, people are asking, well, what if the Hag HaMatzot, the first day of Hag HaMatzot, falls on a Friday? Well, then does that not then determine that Shavuot will be a Shabbat?
Yes. Yes. Well, no, it wouldn't be a Shabbat. What ends up happening then is that our counting would be the same. So if the first day of the Hag HaMatzot happens to fall on Shabbat, then the second day of the Hag HaMatzot will be the first day of the Omer. And that, interestingly, means that both rabbinical and Karaite Jews will count the Omer exactly the same
exactly
way.
Exactly the same, right.
Every once in a while, when it arrives on Friday, when those two coincide, our rabbinical brethren count the Omer correctly, the way the Torah intended. Uh-huh. Every other year, they do it incorrectly, and we do it correctly. But we know for a fact, it's written down in the histories, that this is the way the legitimate Tzaddokite priests, the priests who are celebrated in the scriptures, whose authority comes as descendants of Aharon, the high priest, these priests were endorsed by the prophets to return and reestablish the temple. All the way up through the end of the Hasmonean dynasty, these people led Judaism. That is how they counted the Omer. And for some reason, the Pharisees, who are the forerunners of rabbinical Judaism, wanted to have a different practice so that they could set themselves apart. And we know they had a number of different practices that they set up for no other purpose than to distinguish themselves from the Tzaddokite priests. And this is one of them. And so our rabbinical brethren are kind of stuck with that today.
So let me ask you a question. Let me get this straight in my head. For those who will use the Hillel the second calendar, the rabbinic calendar, to determine the beginning of the year, will then from that point, and let me know if this is what you do, for those who need to put in their leave at work and make sure they have their days off well in advance, we'll base it on the rabbinic calendar, but then we'll implement the such observances as you just put in regards to observing Shavuot and counting the weeks, counting the Omer and so on and so forth. Do that according to the Karaite observation as opposed to the rabbinic. Is this what you do?
Yes. What I do is I look at the day that the first day of the Hag HaMatzot is. I follow to the next Shabbat. And from there, I count 7 weeks. Right. And the next day after the seventh Shabbat, that first Sunday is Shavuot.
And this is where you make your adjustments. So you begin with...
Exactly.
Okay, I'm with you. Okay, right. So,
and you would only take the one day off for Yom Teruah in the fall. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, strangely enough, otherwise the holidays tend to align. Shevi Aseret, the seventh day of the Hag HaMatzot, we all agree on what that day is. Mm-hmm. Yom Kippur, we know what day that is. The Hag HaShavuot, the Hag HaSukkot, and Shmini Aseret, which is also called Simchat Torah, we all agree on what those days are, and so our calendars end up being the same. One minor technicality is, when our rabbinical brethren add a leap month, a 13th month, right, what they call second Adar, mm-hmm, they will move Purim from the 12th month to the 13th month.
Now,
because
I wanted to ask you about this because, of course, we're approaching Purim, right? This is the the next on the list, and we have in nearing the end of the Book of Esther that the month when it is celebrated, and the days on which it is celebrated, and yet what you're saying to me, and I was unaware of this, that in the case of a leap year. Orthodox Judaism will move Purim to the leap year, thereby having it on the 13th month. Have I got this right?
Yes.
Now, why?
Yes. It's their tradition that it should always take place in the last month of the year.
Ah.
For some reason, I don't know and fully understand it. In Karaite tradition, because Queen Esther asked us as Jews to observe as a tradition, not as a commandment. Nowhere does it say this holiday is commanded. Right. As a tradition, because our people prevailed over Haman and his cohorts at that time, we observe this holiday in the 12th month of every year. And so the Karaite tradition is the Purim is always in the 12th month, irrespective of whether we have a leap month. And we will always observe it in the 12th month, and we don't move it. So that's one difference. You're going to have to calculate Purim differently. And on my Facebook group, I post dates every year so that everyone knows what those dates are in advance. And I'll be posting those dates, so we'll have those dates all the way through the rest of the year. So you'll be able to calculate when you need time off in September and October for the 7th month holidays, because you'll have the holidays for the year. And those I include on that list also Holocaust Memorial Day in Israel, Israeli Independence Day, and Jerusalem Liberation Day, which although those are modern sort of Israeli national holidays, we might say Zionist holidays, those are important commemorations for us to remember as well, because the Shoah, the Holocaust, was a terrible loss for Judaism everywhere.
Right.
The establishment of the State of Israel is so important to us as a people, and the liberation of Jerusalem, need I say more? So
now, look, I'm really glad that you brought those up, and Purim. This brings me to a... now, I asked a question on American Karaite Judaism. That's your Facebook group. I'm going to put a link to that. That's a public group. I'm going to put a link to that under this post. I'll also put a link to the article that you have in regards to the calendar, so people can go over it in a little bit more detail. But it does bring me to your Facebook group, because I asked a question, totally unrelated, but it did descend into a conversation about the calendar. And a shout out to Moshe, who was asking some questions in regards to the calendar. Moshe is as an Orthodox Jew, one of the funniest people that I know, on the right side of politics, great sense of humor, really enjoy his posts throughout the entire year. So shout out to Moshe. But he was asking, not being so funny on this particular thread, but he was asking you about Purim, which you just addressed. Do Karaites celebrate Purim or Hanukkah? And you just mentioned a bunch of other dates which you were going to put on your calendar that should be observed. And what quite often, and I see this often, is that sometimes a rabbinic Jew will ask a Karaite, well, what about Purim? What about Hanukkah? Well, you know, that's not in the Torah. So what are you doing? You've got your own tradition. And you go, now, how is this to be properly understood? Because people do get confused with this.
Okay, very, very quickly, I'll descend into my favorite allegory for the Torah, the United States Constitution. You will not find anywhere in the Constitution the words executive orders, separation of church and state, or any reference to the Secretary of the Treasury. They're not in there. Yet, we have those things. Why do we have those things? Because President Washington needed a way to issue orders, so he created this tradition of executive orders. The Constitution provides a president and empowers the president, and the president chose that way of executing his authority. The court in Reynolds v. U.S. decided that there should be a separation of church and state. That is a doctrine, whereas the First Amendment just says that the United States Congress may not establish a national church and compel attendance. This doctrine went farther. The Supreme Court took it farther and said there should be a complete separation between religion and the state. And ultimately, Congress passed a law. Congress, an institution empowered under the Constitution, passed a law creating a Department of the Treasury, and then the Senate confirmed Alexander Hamilton as the first secretary thereof. So what happens in Torah is we have institutions, the priesthood and the Levites, who are to teach the Torah, who establish under that our ritual life and the rules for how we're going to lead it. What is the calendar? How do we slaughter? When do we bring offerings? What offerings do we bring? Above and beyond those things that are listed in the Torah, they provide the details, the tradition and the practice. There are also civil authorities, the king or the judge, shofet, and the various administrative judges and the leaders of the people and so on and so forth. So this is where our tradition and practice comes from. We have this tradition and practice because the Torah creates institutions to provide those details so that we can have a life as a nation. Very much the way the United States Constitution provides institutions that can interpret the Constitution, that can execute the laws, and that can make the laws. So this is where this comes from. There's nothing against creating new days or observances. You cannot create new commandments. Devarim, Deuteronomy 4:2, says very specifically, you may not add new commandments to the Torah, nor may you subtract from those commandments that are written. Right. So, Jonah, if I tell you I'm going to be observing Israeli Independence Day this year, which also happens to be my birthday, very proud of that, then you can say, oh, Isaac, that's great. Maybe we'll have a barbecue. Okay, we'll fly over and we'll have a barbecue together. But I can't tell you, well, Jonah, we're going to say this blessing at our barbecue. Blessed is our God who gave us this commandment to observe this day. Now, why can't we say that blessing?
Because blessed are you, Lord God, who set us apart with his commandments, ordering us to light the barbecue on this day.
Exactly. We can't do that because there is no such commandment written in the Torah. Mm-hmm. So you cannot add a commandment like our rabbinical brethren do. They add separation of meat and dairy. They say that this is commanded. More well-educated rabbinical Jews will back off of that and say, well, no, that's not actually a scriptural commandment found. And they will understand that that is actually a rabbinical commandment. But most rabbinical Jews don't understand that fully. And they will say that it's a biblical commandment. There's a blessing for lighting candles on Shabbat or for lighting candles on Hanukkah that says God commanded us to do this.
Speaking of calendar dates, right. And there is specifically a blessing for lighting the Hanukkiah. Exactly. And it's not a commandment. Okay. And this is the difference. Right. So the problem is not so much implementing tradition and marking dates that are extra to Torah throughout, historical events in Israel. The problem is attributing commandments to those events by God, which he never gave.
Exactly. I will observe the Hag HaMatzot every year, as my ancestors have, as Jews have since the time of King Hizkiyahu, and should have been from that time all the way back to the time of Moshe. But we know that eventually our people did forget and stop observing. I will observe that every year because that is commanded in the Torah. God told Moshe to tell our ancestors, we will do this. Now, if I don't feel like doing Israeli Independence Day today, this year, I don't have to. There's no Torah commandment to do so. Nor is there a Torah commandment to observe Purim. But Queen Esther asked that our people do it as a tradition. So there's no reason that we can't gather and have a good time and read that story and remind ourselves as Jews of this victory. Mm. Likewise for Hanukkah. My family acknowledges it. It's not a Karaite tradition to do Hanukkah, but we do acknowledge it. This is, after all, a great victory of the Sadducite priests and the Hasmonean dynasty over the Seleucids, who were trying to destroy Judaism. And trying to destroy Jews. So this is an important thing to remember, very much along the lines of, say, Israeli Independence Day or maybe the 4th of July here in the U.S. Mm. These are just days that we acknowledge because whatever those things are, they are important to us.
But in your acknowledgement of and memorializing of that event, you, of course, don't say a blessing over the Hanukkiah.
Exactly. We don't say that blessing because it's not commanded. And I can't tell you, like I said, that we're commanded to observe Israeli Independence Day. I think it's safe to say that we would commemorate the return to the land, just as our ancestors did commemorate on Yom Teruah, the return to the land after the first captivity, where Ezra had the Torah read to the people in the morning, and everyone celebrated, and they cleansed themselves, and we had this great acknowledgement that, hey, we're back. The temple's here. Judaism is back on the table. We're back in charge of our land. And that kind of thing.
We have time for one more question. While we're talking about the calendar and talking about years and so on and so forth, we're currently in 5,777. How did we arrive there? Is that date correct? Is that number correct? I mean, how do we arrive there? I'm really interested.
So first, I'll do something very Karaite here and talk about the scriptures. In the Nevi'im, the prophets, the books of Melechim in particular, the dates are set based on the Exodus. So when the temple is built in Jerusalem, King Shlomo had it written that this was 480 years after the exile from Egypt, mm-hmm. right, after the Exodus, after we left Egypt, 480 years, the temple was built. The prophets tell us that we should count the days, count the years from the return, from the exile, circa 538 BCE. That this is the proper time for counting. You will count the years from here. You will say that we have a new covenant. It's like a new exodus from Egypt, mm-hmm. right? That's what the scripture says. But our rabbinical friends have a different counting. And this is a really fun one. I discovered this because I'm kind of a history geek. And mm-hmm. I love Roman history. And I'm a big fan of authors like Livy and Titus and, of course, Josephus. And informally in Roman history, they use a counting of years based upon the foundation of Rome, which they call ab urbe condita, which is, of course, from the foundation of Rome. And most Roman dates are given for the consuls who were in office that year or the regnal years of emperors later on. Mm-hmm. But historically speaking, they'll use this kind of general idea that Rome was founded on this day and we're counting the years from there. And the Roman calendar, ab urbe condita, has 753 more years than the Gregorian, because Pope Gregor, when he was establishing the modern, what we could call the modern Western calendar of the Common Era, or really the Christian calendar, wanted to set the first day of the calendar based on the birth of Yeshua, who was his spiritual character. Mm-hmm. And so he picked 754 of ab urbe condita as the day that that would happen. That happened, that's year one, and then we count, it's 2017 now, right? So if you add those together, and this is kind of fun because this is also the state calendar of France, which they based their year in 1792, which was 2545 on the Roman calendar. Mm-hmm. This year is 2770. Interestingly enough, there's an election happening this year in France because they have their elections on the zeros and fives of every decade in their own state calendar. Mm-hmm. So you take 2770 and you add 3007 to it and you get 5777. And this is a kind of an interesting thing that our rabbinical friends did. They took the Roman calendar in their time, perhaps in Mishnaic times, perhaps later than that, whatever the Roman year happened to be, and they added 3,007 years to it and came up with this number 57, which is now 5777.
Wow.
And that's where they came up with their counting of years, which is a curiosity. And again, there are no coincidences. This is just too convenient that they did this. So that counting of years is an interesting thing. There's no reason to follow it. There's no reason not to follow it. But it is curious how they came up with that number.
It is curious. Now everybody's asking, well where are we? Since the Exodus, what year are we?
Since the Exodus is a very good question, because, of course, historical evidence would point to a year more like 1500 BCE, although there's also some good evidence for earlier, still earlier dates. If we counted the years that way, it'd be 3500 something, approximately, depending on what year we set as the base year. Okay. If we go with the prophets and what they tell us to count from the return, then this year is 2555, because it's been about 2555 years since Jews returned from the exile, right. You know, from the Babylonian captivity.
Okay.
So you can count the years in a number of different ways. And again, you know, there's no reason not to say that it's 5777. But it is interesting to know the source of that and to understand where that counting comes from.
It really is. And I had no idea. That is fascinating. Once again, the article is simply entitled The Jewish Calendar. I will put a link under this post. It is on Silver Trumpets, the website of Isaac Kite. The address is BnaiMikra.wordpress.com, BnaiMikra.wordpress.com. I'll put a link. Also, again, managing the Facebook group, American Karaite Judaism. Lots of fun in that group. And there'll be a link under this post. My friend, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You.
Do appreciate it. Always an honor. Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Truth to You with me, John O'Vandor. Join me on the coming Truth to You Israel tour. Details at our website, truthtoyou.org. That's truth, number two, letter U.org. Thank you for your company, and I hope you'll join us again. Until next time, shalom.